This is Viva Con Agua.
I give you five words and you give me five quotes. Which come first to your mind? Art. Okay.
Sorry, so you...
Art. I give you five words.
Five words.
And you just give me a quote which comes occasionally to your
okay.
mind. Art.
Play.
Who said it?
Oh, a quote. Yes. I thought you meant the word that associates with it. All right, start again.
Art.
A quote. You want a quote by someone
yes.
else.
Yeah, okay. Because when I hang around with you, you always quote other people.
That's true.
Not that you don't have something to say. Nevertheless, you always quote somebody.
I'm just relying on the wisdom of great people to live my life. I'm standing on the shoulders of giants, man.
Yeah, no problem. You're small like me. I know your drummers.
So, quotes. One about art. I mean, that's a difficult one because there's so many good quotes about art. But my favorite is maybe by Picasso. He said, art is a lie that helps you realize the truth. Boom.
Boom.
Shaka Khan.
Before we go to the next word, I would love to introduce my first English-speaking podcast person ever. So, sorry for all the mistakes. I have to admit, I stopped studying university when I was 26 semesters. I studied English. And so I never finished this, so that's the reason why my English normally sucks. This is Mr. David Schillinglaw. We are here in the Scandic Hotel, one of our partners where we do all the art rooms. And so we continue with the second word, love.
Find the thing you love and let it kill you. Which is an interesting quote because I thought for years it was by Charles Bukowski. He's a famous American writer.
But it's not.
It's not. And I found that out because I sometimes write things on mattresses, you know, in the street. And I wrote, find the thing you love and let it kill you, quote, Charles Bukowski. And someone on the internet said, that's not by Bukowski, you muppet.
I would laugh much more if the person had wrote it on a mattress, you know, like a red... pen.
Yeah.
Put it down and
X. Say, X. Wrong. But I can't remember who actually said it. It's someone else from America, some old writer. But that is a good quote about love. Find the thing you love and let it kill you. Bow.
Third word. School.
School? A quote about school? Oh, man. I'm not sure. I haven't got one that involves that particular word. But there is a quote about learning, I think, or understanding that I love, which is by Brian Eno. What does he know?
Mm-hmm.
The famous musician from Roxy Music. And he said that children understand through play and adults play through art.
Love it.
Yeah, I like that.
I said school because I knew that nothing could come out because I don't like school. You've been good in school?
I was good at some stuff. I went to quite a strict school. I went to a school just for boys, which I'd never really wanted to go to, but I went because my older brother went there, and it was a good school. And if your brother went there, you just got in. And then the year I went, the next year they stopped that and you had to do an exam. So I was the last year of the stupid kids, basically. So the school was like a prison for young boys. And it was full of the bullshit that you can imagine at an English... Not posh, because like I said, when I got in, it wasn't fancy. You didn't have to pay to get into this school. But they thought they were fancy. That's the worst kind of school, when they're not fancy, but they think they are. And it was like they were 100 years behind. The teachers were like... prison officers calling you by your second name.
What's your second name?
Schillinglaw. Schillinglaw! And I just fucking hated it. It was so serious. And I'm not a serious person. And I'm serious about not being serious. I take that really seriously. And they were into sport. And I'm not particularly sporty. Especially rugby. And I really didn't love... It was like fighting. It was like we were encouraged to fight with a ball. And the other was, academic subjects, math, science, English, which again, I can be good at it if I really want to be, but I'm more of a someone, believe it or not, who's sitting drawing pictures in their sketchbook. So luckily, thank God, art was a subject because it saved me. And I think that's one of the reasons I'm so obsessed and still very into art, because it was the thing that saved me. It was the happy place at school. In a way, if I'd been to a school where maybe there were, where they were doing drama or music, or if there were loads of girls and not doing rugby, I probably wouldn't have done so much art, because art was the thing that was my escape from the bullshit. So I didn't like it. To answer your question, no, I hated it. But I think it taught me discipline for sure, because I'm not naturally disciplined. I'm a naughty boy and I would get in trouble all the time. I'm talking a lot.
Is the human nature disciplined? Like when you come into life, and I'm thinking about my little baby also, is she disciplined or you have to train it?
No, because I was watching your daughter last night, and while she was eating, she wasn't just ramming food in her face. She was carefully taking the bits of spaghetti and putting them into the pot. And then she was picking bits out, even in a very, how old is she?
1 year and 6 months.
So really basic, but there was still organization. She wasn't just hungry, like an animal. Humans are, I think, we like pattern. We like order. We like structure. Mm-hmm. Often we like order and structure so that we can then rebel. You know, the rules are sometimes good because they give you something to push against. If you just said to humans, get up whatever time you want, do whatever you want, it wouldn't work. We need, like dogs actually, dogs need the master. And I think humans, as much as we fantasize about anarchy and freedom, like total freedom, I've got some friends who are really into basically fuck the police. And I'm always a bit like, what if there were no police? Can you imagine that? Like the police are arguably corrupt and not always on the right side. If that, who's even to say what's right or wrong? But if you take away the rules and what take away the discipline, like you said, do humans, are they disciplined? If you take it away, people don't know what to do with that freedom. I think freedom is disciplining yourself. My dad used to say it to me when I was a kid, actually. Freedom is the right to discipline yourself. And people don't see that. They think freedom is the right to do what you want when you want. No, freedom is the right to say, right, I'm going to get up every day at 7 so that I can then stay in bed 2 days a week until 12. But being an artist, actually, you need discipline and structure. Otherwise, you just end up doing nothing, procrastinating. You need deadlines. I think artists, I do any, I work well with a gun to my head.
I like to transform the word of deadline to lifeline.
Lifeline, yeah.
Which brings me to word number 4.
Go on then. Life. Oh man, there's loads of quotes about life. I'm actually quite bad at remembering quotes. So sometimes it's frustrating because I can kind of see it in my head. Isn't there, John Lennon might have said life is what happens while you're busy making plans.
I think it was somebody else, but I know it. Yeah,
that's okay. A nice one, but yeah. I can't remember who said it. Life.
Let's go with this one. Take number 5, word number 5.
Oh, I'll tell you a nice quote, actually. Life is like riding a bicycle. To keep balance, you must keep moving forwards. Einstein said that. Albert motherfucking Einstein.
You like Einstein?
Yeah, he was a nice guy, wasn't he? He was pretty funky.
I never met him.
No, but generally his personal life, I've read things about him. He was a sweet, kind man, and he was quite eccentric. I think he was dyslexic. He was kind of out there. Look at his hairstyle. I always say, look at someone's hairstyle. If it's too neat and combed and proper, not too sure. His hair was like Don King. He was mental. He had this frizzy afro. So yeah, Einstein, top banana.
Word number 5, last one, water.
Is the driving force of all nature. Water is the driving force of all nature. Leonardo da Vinci said that.
So let's bring it to the moment we first met. I remember it like yesterday almost. You were in the arena. You were kind of dancing a little bit. You were listening to some music. I have no idea what you listened at that time, and you were painting the first wall on the end of the south area of the Millantor Gallery, and you had no idea what you were doing.
No. Well, I knew that it was about water, and that was that quote by Da Vinci was the title I'd given it. Mm-hmm. Water is the driving force of all nature. And I remember it well because I was excited to paint a mural for your charity, because I really have for the longest time seen the relationship between art and causes. Artists are often called upon to donate work or donate time or even to help. Hey, can you talk about this thing? Because art is a way of drawing attention to something serious. So I was excited because it was a really interesting charity, what you're doing. I really thought, yeah, this is amazing, making drinking water. And I remember you saying something to me about the drinking water bottle. You said, our advertising strategy is there is nothing special about this water. Buy it. It's the same as all the other waters. And I like that your energy, you and Marcel, was it?
Yeah.
I met you guys. And it was just an energy. I was like, oh, these guys know how to have fun. And actually what you're doing isn't making money. It's making things to make water. Water's the end result. It's not lots of money. It's like, stop talking about the money. Let's do things that are going to build a well. And I really like that because it's a basic need. It's before anything, before you have any computers or fancy offices, everyone needs a glass of water. If you don't, in 3 days, you die. So it really struck a chord. And still has. Like, I've worked with lots of different charities, lots of different issues, whether it be mental health or homelessness. I'm still sure that what you guys are doing, it's both local and global. There's no, it's a democratic situation. Everyone needs water, whether you're the Queen of England or the homeless guy in the street. This is something that's interesting for everyone. That's why it's great.
You know that we changed the system from that time to now?
No, I don't.
Because when you came, I think it was still almost 100% donated by the artist. So
now you give a bit of commission to the artist.
Exactly.
By choice, if they want.
Yeah.
That's good, because a lot of times charities expect you to give a painting for free. And they say, oh, but in return, you'll get exposure or promotion, which actually, if they're asking you for art, you probably don't need the promotion. That's the irony, isn't it? But
And if you can give the art, then you don't need anything.
Yeah.
Because you're in the position to give. Yeah. And the ones who need the exposure actually need the money
Well. And it's also, because I'm learning now the power of saying no. Because sometimes I get asked to do things for charity. And I mean once a month at least, if not once a week, I get an email saying, we've got this charity, can you donate, ... And now I have to say no, because I would rather put more energy and more time and more money into one or two things. And especially the experience we had in Ethiopia, what I did with Viva Con Agua, and the continuation of our relationship over now like 7 years, it feels like I have something invested. It feels like it's influencing my work. It actually feels like what you guys are doing is affecting me personally and the actual substance of my work. It feels like it's on my mind.
You feel the same way the other way around?
What do you mean?
Like, you said that our work is affecting you.
Yeah.
You think your work is affecting us?
I don't know that for sure. I know that my work can make money for you, and it can become an advert. Like, my work can become the face.
We just agreed on the story about one, that it's not about money. Second, that it's not about advertising, because it's just the water.
But it is so, both about those as well. It has to be about those.
Yes, both and. But I think, like, for example, the project you just did in Ethiopia with the rig is one of the most craziest, biggest, most powerful and beautiful projects we've ever did so far. Yeah. Nobody knows yet, really, because it's like a little baby. It was just born. Although it's 20 meters long, and I think the giving birth was a pain in the ass, but it's probably the most efficient project we've done.
Yeah, when I say it's affected me personally, I feel like it's affected my spirit, and the spirit of my art as well as the spirit of me personally. it makes me feel good in a way that money and fame can't. You can have all the money in the bank, but if you're not feeling good about yourself, and you can have as many followers on Instagram as you could possibly get, but if you don't believe it, or you don't feel like you're doing the right thing, it doesn't mean anything. Whereas painting a truck for you guys to dig wells in Africa, and seeing the whole process of you getting it, me painting it, then going to Ethiopia and watching it drill a hole, and then going to the site where people are drinking water, there aren't actually words to really describe how that made me feel. It was a pride. It's definitely pride, but it's not the same as selling something pride. It's a pride that you give away immediately. So it's like the pride that I felt it because of the happiness of other people. And that's a strange kind of pride, because it's almost like anti-ego. It's like extreme empathy. It's like being rewarded for just being who you are by looking at other people being happy, and you get this genuine feeling of satisfaction, which is very strange. There's not many things. Maybe the closest thing is when you make really good food and you watch other people eat it. That's a good feeling. And actually, sometimes, you know, when you make loads of food, you're not hungry afterwards. You're not even feeling good because it's feeding you. But you see the people you love and they're like, oh, this is amazing. That's what I felt in Ethiopia. But they were like a 10-year-old girl filling up a bucket with water. And she can't even speak to me. She doesn't even know that I painted the machine. So I'm anonymous. I'm just a white guy in a field in Africa. But I'm looking at them all, and it was like I'd won a competition to see their faces getting fresh water, a cosmic lottery. And honestly, I feel like very few times in my life do I get to do something like that. Even giving money to a homeless person in the street, yeah, it makes me feel good. But what did I give him? I gave him a euro. Who cares? I think it's an interesting lesson for me to learn.
You know, there's a comparison which comes into my mind, like giving 1 euro, 2 euro to a homeless is like giving 10 years or 100 years to Viva Con Agua in a way, if it's a transfer of money. But sitting to a homeless person and speak to him and sharing a meal is like flying to Ethiopia and seeing the little one take a bucket and stuff like that. So what I would advise everyone is, like, if you go by a homeless person, sit down and talk to
them. Absolutely. Humanize them. Don't just give them money. No. Ask their name and shake their hand. Exactly. That's difficult. And it's funny, I just chatted to York from Helium Cowboy about this, because we were talking about the ethics and the difficulty in art, the relationship between art and charity. Because a lot of artists use it as a promotional tool. Look at me, look how good I am. And actually, there's an interesting term which I like, which is selfish acts of kindness. Now, I had this experience when I made friends. I didn't make friends with him, but there was a homeless guy in my local neighborhood. Now, I find it really interesting that a lot of people, you see a charity thing about, oh, the tsunami in wherever, and you donate money, but you ignore the homeless person on your street. So I started to buy this guy cigarettes, a few drinks. I bought him a pair of shoes. And I thought, that's really interesting, because this is actually, I'm making him feel okay, but actually I'm making myself feel better. But really, if I wanted to help this guy, I should have set up a bank account for him. I should have given him a room in my house for free. I should have given him a shower. And I started to really grapple with the problems of local responsibility. Because it's easy to donate money to a charity dealing with tsunami, because I donate £20 and I go about my day, I feel like I've done a good thing. What's really difficult is you go up to someone, don't just give them a euro, sit down and say, hey, what's your name? Where do you come from? What led you here? And how can I really help? If you want a drink, I'll get you a drink. But is that really going to help? What about
teaching you how to paint?
Or setting you up somewhere to live? And I'm talking about homelessness, but there's, you know, 1,000 ways to make people feel better.
I really try never to judge why somebody is giving something or being part of Viva Con Agua. For me, it's not a question if somebody does it because of fame, does it because of responsibility, does it because of an inner motivation, or because his father said you have to be good to people, or because he likes Viva Con Agua, or because he wants to impress a woman. I don't give a shit.
Well, everyone has a different agenda, don't they?
Exactly.
And a different way to measure success and charity.
But I think it could be interesting to go with the homeless person and explain him a little bit about the art world and do an exhibition with him.
Well, it's been done. And there's a few, funnily enough, there's a few artists who've become quite popular because they were homeless and because that's almost a gimmick. Like, oh, look at this guy, he's homeless and he's making art. Let's. Yeah.
It's a second layer of communication for the poor press.
Yeah, it is a, exactly, it's a PR kind of angle.
Yeah,
I would say it's a really difficult thing, especially, I mean, I don't live in London anymore, but when I lived in London, it's very difficult. People are literally stepping over bodies. There are bodies in the street sometimes, and you're like, this guy could be dead, and no one's even doing anything about it. Which is really strange.
In Ethiopia, it almost happened. I was 5 days ago, and I was at night, and we came out of the studio, and I was walking on the street, and I almost hit a person on the floor. I felt so fucking ashamed, because I was not giving awareness. I was actually probably writing a message.
It's very difficult, because to really do it, like I said, you've got to give someone... Like, you invest a lot of time and money, and I've grappled with it. This homeless guy that I... bought shoes for, I really thought, oh, I'm in it now. What am I going to have to get for him next? And actually, he disappeared. I never saw him again. After like 2 weeks, he just went. Because a lot of people do. They move to another town or they just keep moving. But I remember thinking, wow, I now can't walk past this guy. I know his name. He knows who I am. I bought him a pair of shoes. I'm now in this relationship with this homeless guy. It's much easier to...
He dropped you.
Yeah, he ghosted me, he blocked me. No, but I think it's a much easier to, like I said, to ignore people and to just donate something remotely to a global issue. And it's a very interesting psychology, because I think it's actually at the heart of a lot of our problems is the lack of community. And that the ability to ignore someone who you're walking past, who probably the same person of you, they're just unlucky. Maybe they're... family died, maybe they lost their job, maybe they've got mental health problems. You don't know what caused them to be begging. And obviously drugs and alcohol come into that at some point, because it's an easy way to escape the reality of living in the street. But what a problem is, I think, for a lot of us, is that it's easy to ignore the local problems and instead focus on a global problem. That's interesting.
When you say lack of community, is it not also if you think on a global community level and you buy clothes from Bangladesh and don't think about the water which was produced, or you eat avocados and don't think about Mexico?
Absolutely.
Or stuff like that? So the lack of community is on a local level, but also on a global level the same.
Yeah, I think a lot of the global communities that we're a part of are fictional narratives. When you think about certain ways of organizing the world into developed or developing, into Germany and England, into rich and poor, we kind of fit quite nicely into, oh, I'm this person, I live here, I speak this language, I wave that flag. But actually, it's funny, we were talking about this earlier with Jorg, and I was saying that, because he brought up Brexit, and I was like, oh, I don't really want to talk about Brexit, but it is interesting to me how divided the world is becoming. Rich and poor, right and wrong, right and left. Are you black and white? All of these things. What's interesting is that the way someone votes or the way that someone thinks that you might disagree with completely, like you're a fascist online, if you put that person in a room with you and had a cup of tea, you'd probably get on. Because humans, generally, it's easier to make friends with someone than an enemy.
One of the most... funniest, or it's not really funny, nevertheless it's funny, I don't know, I just try not to value it again, but I had this night where my good friend Lars, he was talking like for hours to a racist in a bar, and at the end they agreed they don't come together, went out and beat each other the ass
off.
Did
they?
Yeah.
Okay, so maybe it doesn't always work.
No, it doesn't always work, and it was so...
Who won? Did the fascist or the...
Nobody won. How can somebody win in a fight?
No one wins the human race, man.
Yeah. So, but it was crazy, like talking for hours.
So they actually had a fight at the end of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess that's one way to try and settle it. I believe in human kindness, and I believe in my...
Oh, shit.
That's not going to sound good.
No.
Cut.
No, we don't cut it.
I believe in the good nature of people, and I believe that you can always, even if you agree to disagree, there's always places to find like a something that you both agree on. Like, this coffee is hot, we both agree on that. We both need water. That's another thing, getting back to this universal sort of appetite, that actually a lot of the stuff that people focus on, i.e. your political views, or your amount of money in your bank account and your class divide, a lot of it's nonsense. You take someone in the, and put them in the middle of a field, take them away from a flushing toilet, a running tap and electricity, and we're all the same. And put them on an island together, and I've seen it happen on limited ways when I've been in places without the internet, for example, or when you're in a close environment with someone traveling and you don't know them. Let's say I go and do a project with some other artists and they're different people. They come from different places. Maybe they've got different political views. There's 15 years difference. But after a week, you're all kind of coexisting. And that's something that humans do really well. Even if we pick fights with each other and claim I'm right, you're wrong, after a while, I've seen it happen that people just sort of get along. Or they don't, they stay out of each other's way. Maybe I'm wrong, maybe I'm just seeing...
It sounds like a TV show, actually.
Well, there are.
There's Jungle Camp?
No, I haven't seen it.
No, but you know it? Heard about? I don't know if it exists.
No, but I've seen hundreds of other ones, like where celebrities get put in a jungle or go and sit on a desert island and the first one who gets diarrhea gets voted off.
Yeah, exactly. Sounds a little bit like that. But there would be the question, like, I was thinking the whole time, is it really like that or people are the same? Because I imagine a really person who never experienced something like that, to, for example, to not have water. I, for example, my first really time was in Mozambique. We were a large group. The electricity went off and then the water went off. And it was for 3 days. So we had to buy water. Of course, we had still water, but nevertheless, there was no running water. There was no shower. And after 3 days, the atmosphere was really, not good no more. Because, of course, all the ladies didn't like to be washed. And it was hard for everybody. So it was my first experience not having clean access to clean water for the first time.
It's difficult. Really difficult.
And I think some people who are quite used to it would handle it much better than a person who would never experience anything.
What's interesting about my experience in Ethiopia was there were 3 days when I didn't have a shower in a row. And I felt rough. If you wake up and don't have... I'm so used to wake up, the first thing I do is have a shower. It's almost like coffee for my entire body, you know. It's like washing my body just wakes me up. Sometimes I have 2 showers a day. And then drinking water, obviously, just out of the tap or just bottled water. And then flushing toilet, you don't even think about it. You really don't. If you suddenly are in a situation where either you don't have a toilet to flush or the toilet is just a hole in the ground, it changes your whole, the privacy and the comfort of going for a shit. And what's interesting is that we live in the developed world, what they call the developed world, which I'm not sure about that terminology. I feel like it is a strange way to describe a world where we're so reliant on resources and things that are out of our control. So electricity, flushing toilets and running water. Yeah, we're developed. But what happens when they all go? If someone said, right, no toilet, no sink and no electricity, we'd be really in trouble. Whereas people who live in the developing world, who have to walk 4 miles to get water, have to go to the toilet in a hole, and who don't have electricity unless they have a generator, they actually know what it's like to protect themselves and to find that energy and to get rid of their waste. So in many ways, we look at it like, oh, they're developing. But actually, no, I think they have a more developed sense of those things that are so important to a normal life. And in England, I wonder how long it would last if suddenly the water stopped coming out the tap and the toilets didn't flush and electricity was cut off. I reckon within a week, there would be riots in the street. And people would be fighting in the supermarkets over food and drink. People would be scared. People would start getting sick because within a week of taking shits in the toilets, people would get ill. And I just think that's really interesting that we're this close all the time to being essentially a refugee. If you take away those three things, electricity, running water, and flushing toilet, you're a refugee. Even if you've got a house, everything will fall apart. And I feel like that's something I've only realised recently growing up. It's taken me 35 years to realise that I'm actually not in control. Actually, I think I am, because I go to the tap and turn it on. But who's providing the water? Where does my water come from? Where does my shit go? I've no idea. No idea.
I like your way of thinking, and still I would disagree in a way, because a refugee is one more thing. You don't have a safe place with your family where you can stay.
Maybe a refugee is the wrong word, because a refugee is someone who literally doesn't have a place to call home.
And he has to leave home.
As long as you have that, maybe you're empowered and you're like, this is my area. These are my
comfort
boundaries. And yeah, this is my family's roof. And yeah, so maybe refugee is the wrong word. Again, there's lots of different ways to describe things.
It's just
as soon
label,
as you change the word.
You know, there was a big discussion also about the word of refugee, and because it's just a label you put on to describe and put them into boxes. And it's not describing them as humans and people. Because, for example,
so maybe displaced person is a better way to express it. Because refugee, you know, just has such a terrible association to... And also migrant. There's different ways of talking about immigrants and migrants. Well, whereas someone who goes... When an English person goes to live in Australia...
He's a migrant. Yeah.
But we're seen as either gap years or expats. There's different ways to...
Expatriate.
And it's like, no, we're migrants.
Yeah.
We're migrating.
Yeah.
It just happens that some people migrate because, oh, I can make more money in Australia. Other people migrate
because the sun is shining.
Yeah, because it's sunny. Or other people, like Syrian people... don't leave because they make more money in Europe. They leave because their house has been blown apart. So I often think it's interesting how we frame the terms that we use to describe people can completely change the way we think about their situation.
And it was yesterday, it was like the day of Holocaust.
Yes. So what was that actually celebrating?
No,
how many years since then?
Celebrating? Sorry, we don't celebrate it.
Well, you're celebrating...
Remembrance Day.
Yeah, okay.
It's
maybe, again,
celebrating
the words I use to describe things, maybe it's wrong. Celebrating, remembering it.
Remembrance.
Yeah, it's still a celebration. No, it's not a celebration.
Not at all. And it was funny because I posted on social media, never again, and there were quite a few smart people who said, why? Why are you saying never again? It's happening at the moment when you watch the seas and the Middle Sea. And people are dying and every day. So we not... Sometimes you think we are more developed and made this progress. And still, on the other hand, you see that so little changes.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the other hand, if you go through facts, then you have like probably the time where you have less war, you have less people dying. But you have most people, on the other hand, migrating. We have 65 million people who are currently running around the world and not having a safe home.
Displaced
people.
There's more people alive now, though, aren't there, than there have ever been.
So percentage-wise, probably.
So what was the thing yesterday? What's the date? Why is that the day that you choose to remember that?
It's the 27th January, and I think this was the day of the Holocaust. If I remember.
What, there wasn't one day, was it? The Holocaust lasted ages.
Yeah, it lasted ages.
But this is just the day that you say, this is the day we remember it.
Yeah.
Okay, I just wondered if something special had happened that day. Like they closed the last concentration camp or...
I think something like that, exactly. Look it up. You just tell me a story about...
I'll tell you something that's interesting. I read a statistic the other day talking about how never again, like you said, that in the last... Apparently... In Congo, the Republic of Congo, this is a really sad statistic, but apparently in the last 15 years, 20 million people have died there.
In the Congo?
Because of the civil wars, and a lot of those wars are created by conflict minerals, so that you can use Instagram on your iPhone and watch movies on your laptop. Yes. Cobalt and coltan is mined there, which creates these civil wars. And it's interesting that we talk about the transatlantic slave trade or the Holocaust and be like, this should never happen again. But it's still happening.
Every
it's just
day.
Reframed as a different war, a different reason, a different rhyme. And actually, a lot of people maybe don't realise that they're contributing towards it. It's almost impossible to separate yourself from the problems of the world because it's all interwoven, isn't it? The way we live. Everyone's got a mobile phone. Those phones are made by children in China and there's a mineral in them which is mined in the Congo. That's depressing.
Yeah.
It's not going to stop.
No. We got more people having the free access to Wi-Fi than to clean water.
Yeah, is that a good thing? I wonder. No.
And yes. Like
the internet, you can learn a lot, can't you, from the internet?
And you can be connected. And you know about the persons in the Congo. So it's also about the knowledge about it and to progress. So it's always both sides.
Yeah.
And to now, I looked it up, like you were thinking, it's the... So in a way, it could also be a celebration. I was wrong because they remember the day, the 27th of January, when Auschwitz was conquered.
There you go.
And
it was a celebration. It's a celebration of the end of a terrible thing.
Exactly. So you're right.
I was right. And wrong. I was worried. Well, yeah. I'm always wrong and right at the same time.
This is probably like the solution to all questions.
Yes, being right and wrong. Well, that is something I always think of when I'm having slight... disagreement with someone. Let's say you're having a debate about whether you should eat meat or whether you should vote Brexit. And I always remember in the back of my mind that everyone, even if you think they're wrong, they think they're right. And how can a huge amount, even the people who think the world is flat, if there's enough people who believe it, then they believe it. You can't say to someone, you're wrong. All you can say is, you've got a slightly different way of framing reality. My reality is different to yours. Although me saying that something was a celebration when it's remembrance, there are nuances to language which you could definitely offend people with. Absolutely. Like calling someone an immigrant rather than an expat.
What I really had to learn is that I'm not the one to judge when I offend somebody. The only one who judges, who's able to judge it, is the person.
Is God. God's got a great sense of humor.
Crazy words. No, but really, like with the right or wrong, I'm so pleased with it because when we do the Milano Galli for example, at the end of the festival we throw away like two containers of trash. Mm-hmm. So the festival is definitely right. The motivation is right. We want to change the world. We want to make it a better place. We want to be creative, we want to invite people from all over the world, want to have a platform, everything's right. And at the end we throw away two containers of trash. So this is wrong. So you can't do something without like really doing a lot of mistakes.
And it's whether you can do it better next time. I just had my little zine that I gave you called Fail Better. That quote is a beautiful quote that is, ever tried, ever failed, no matter... try again, fail again, fail better.
Samuel Beckett.
So next time you do a festival, maybe you think, well, last time we used this many bits of wood which got thrown away, maybe next year we can donate them to someone for firewood or whatever. So you learn from it. But I also think in terms of being right or wrong, when you learn from that kind of ethical mistakes rather than the material byproduct, if you go, I did that wrong because I offended a lot of people, right? I just think empathy is the key. As long as you're able to put yourself into someone else's shoes and think, wow, how would I have done it better for them? Then I think you're learning from it, if that makes sense. I think there's different ways of seeing the success and failure. And I think empathy is the key to it. Just try and understand it through other people's eyes. And just try and do it better next time if you've got the opportunity to. Whether that's a conversation with someone about Brexit... and think, next time I do that, I'm going to ask a question rather than say a statement. Let them think about what I'm doing in a different way. The same as if you're doing a festival. It's like, next time I do that, we won't use plastic at all. We'll use glass bottles because we can recycle those. Fail better. That's all you can do. How can you fail better? It's good, actually. That's kind of a mantra for me, because I'm constantly failing. In fact, most of my artwork comes out of failing.
It's funny, you just said something beautiful, which I totally agree on, not doing a statement, but asking a question. Then you said, fail better. Then you said, how can you fail better? So you corrected yourself throughout your monologue. And it's funny, because really, like, what I love about a lot of artists, but especially about you, you have something to say. And you use the art to constantly telling people things. And for me, it's also when we spoke about this universal language approach and about Viva Con Agua using the language, it's always affecting us. And the only the way to work with artists, I'm constantly learning how to work with artists because it's difficult. It's not easy. And sometimes it's not Viva Con Agua, I call it Diva Con Agua, but it's just funny way of coping my not being able to work with artists on top level already, because there are so many expectations, there are so many needs in working with artists, and it's difficult. And on the other hand, it's quite easy, because the only rule is to let him do what he wants to do. And then he changes Viva Con Agua from the appearance. He's not changing the DNA, because the DNA is quite strong with Viva Con Agua, and it's quite easy. It's actually just play. Play and do something. But at the end, how it appears. And this is why, for me, Viva Con Agua is like this. I don't know the quote really, but it's like you can never jump into the same river.
I don't know that quote.
But it's quite same, because if the moment you jump in a river and then you come out, and you jump again,
it's a different bit of water.
It's a different bit of water. The same is with Viva Con Agua. The moment you have a conversation about Viva Con Agua, the person who gets into Viva Con Agua is changing it. Maybe slightly, maybe really slightly. Maybe sometimes even not positive, but nevertheless, it's a new kind of river. And you paint it. You paint our river.
It's funny, getting back to what you were saying about universal language and like being able to use art to tell a story in a way, because every time someone... A piece of art, let's just say a painting, because there's films, there's dance, there's food. You can have all kinds of art. But I'm interested in drawing and painting. That has as many ways of reading it as there are people to look at it. You know, there's 7.5 billion humans. That's 7.5 billion agendas. There's 7.5 billion opinions. That's 7.5 billion ways of seeing the world. And that is determined by your parents or the people that raised you. It's depending on your language and your cultural expectations, your dreams, your fantasies, your secrets. Some people, their opinions are affected by the way they feel, because maybe they brought up, they're gay, but everyone around them thinks they're straight. Imagine that. Imagine you're living in Uganda where it's illegal to be gay and you're gay. And you grow up with this twisted self-hate because everyone around you said it's terrible to be gay. So you grow up thinking, oh God, I'm terrible. Your opinions about everything is going to have a slight... it's going to be slightly affected by the way you feel about yourself. Now, if you go to another country where gay pride is like... In Holland, where gay pride is like this biggest festival ever and you grow up gay, you'd have a completely different opinion of yourself. So your opinion of yourself and your opinion of your environment is often sort of... tied up in who you are, what you've learned. So when someone looks at a painting, this is my point, when someone looks at a painting, they're bringing to that all of their own shit. So it's a very difficult thing to say one thing with a painting. And if you are saying one thing, then usually you're a graphic designer or some kind of illustrator, where you've got one point to make. And some of the best art does that. Some of the greatest artists are able to say one thing and the whole world see that picture and they all see the same thing. And I don't know if I could ever do that. I feel like comfortable making art that has 7.5 billion different ways of reading it. Because I want this vegan, communist, gay, gender neutral black guy to have an opinion, as well as this 5-year-old Chinese hermaphrodite who only eats fruit. You know, everyone's got to have their own opinion. And I think that is maybe the strength and the weakness of art. Because not like a word where you write it, you know, drink Coca-Cola. There's no ambiguity there. I'm telling you to drink Coca-Cola. But I'm not interested in having a full stop at the end of my painting. I want 7.5 billion people to read it 7.5 billion different ways. But then... if you can conjure something, you know, like, you know how all barbecues smell the same? Even if you're barbecuing vegan food or meat or whatever in Mexico or China, someone's having a barbecue. And everyone will know that it's a barbecue, but then they get there and it's different. So that's kind of my aim, is to, for all my work to have the same smell, but when you get there, it's as different as the person eating it. Does that make sense?
No.
No.
Because, no, yes.
No, yes, everything. Yes, no.
Like, you were speaking about Coca-Cola. I think McDonald's tries exactly this, the same thing. The, wherever you go, the hamburger smells and tastes the same.
Yeah.
Which I think is the most boring thing.
It's disgusting.
It's disgusting. It would be interesting to try to do an art exhibition which works in all the countries differently, but slightly differently. I was speaking with artists about doing an art exhibition only for children, because most art exhibitions are eye on eye level for adults, but not for children.
Oh, you put it down.
So put it down.
For short
people. It would be really small.
And adults difference. Have to go on their knees.
Exactly. It would be just a small difference, but it would change the whole system, how you the perspective on the art. And I think it could be really interesting to try to organize an art exhibition which goes around the world. Goes every fucking country in this world, even the ones which are not
And you can approved. Call it on your knees.
Oh, you can call it on your knees if you want, but but on your knees would not work all over the world, because no. You have to change the language.
Well, this is the interesting thing we were saying the other day in our talk about universal language. It doesn't really exist, because, like I just said, there's 7.5 billion pairs of eyes. And even, for example, I was talking about this yesterday, like art for blind people. I'm often totally struck different. With this kind of difficulty, because someone once asked me this question, how would you describe what you make to someone who can't see? And for me, that's really painful for even thinking about that, because that's, it's not, my work is exclusively really for people who can see.
Is it?
Well, unless you make textured art that people
can... Did you ever try to explain it to somebody?
Well, in that interview I did, but I didn't do a very good job of it. It was... A silly
Why?
Answer.
Who said it to you?
Some journalist from Vienna. And I said...
But did he... could he see?
Yeah. So they were more asking me to describe in words what a visual thing looked like. But then everything I make is slightly different. So one thing can be different to the other. It's a really... That's an impossible question. Describe something to someone who can't see. Because
Why?
It's not impossible, but it's going to be different depending on the person you're talking to and depending on what I'm describing. If I make a painting on canvas that's mainly red...
We always, in this podcast, yes, still we're having a podcast, although we're just speaking to each other maybe, but we always ask people to write us emails or to do anything, to participate. Actually, to be honest, never anything happened yet. But nevertheless, we ask now a person, to write us an email so we can describe an artwork of David Chillingnor to see if he's doing a good job or not.
I tell you, it's very difficult. Let's take the print that we're just printed. How would I describe that to someone who can't see? Because straight away, I'd say it's four colours. What's colour to someone who can't see? I mean, some blind people can see light.
Yeah, and I see
certain types, but not everyone, because there's a gradient.
No, but they know the idea of colour.
Do they?
I think
so. They know the word colour, but try and describe red to someone who's never seen red.
No, it's like... what you feel when you are in love.
Ooh, I'd say blue is a lovely colour.
No, blue is what happens when you go swimming.
Now, you see, there's 7.5 billion ways of seeing the colour red. So this, going back to the universal language thing, what it interests me is, ultimately, I want...
Fire.
Fire to someone who's blind. Okay, hot. Heat.
Hot. Heat.
Yeah, but white flame is the hottest, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
So, and yellow, the colour of the sun...
To be it's honest, difficult. We have no
idea. I've spent two years thinking about that, and it's one of the reasons I love audio.
There's this restaurant here in Hamburg. I invite you next time.
Is it blind people serving you in a dark room?
Yeah.
Are they naked? Don't order the sausage.
You dirty old boy.
So listen, one of the reasons I love podcasts...
Have you ever been there?
No, I've heard about it, though.
Okay.
A blind person told me about it. So one of the reasons I love audio is that it does give visual... Because I talk a lot. And I talk a lot of shit. And one of the things I love is that my pictures don't make noise. But in a way, I'm trying to make pictures that are loud. The colours are bright. There's a lot going on. It's like listening to four songs at the same time, but being able to dance to it with your eyes. And one of the things I love about podcasts is that it isn't a visual landscape. We're talking about things, and there's a magic to it, because I can maybe say certain things which people can see.
But well, most people do something visual at the moment. Either watch a movie, write emails.
Not necessarily. I sometimes listen to podcasts just walking on the beach, just because I like the space.
Yeah, but then you have something visual.
Sure. One of the things I love about it is I can be in my studio making art while listening to a podcast. But it's fascinating for
what
me to give...
What podcasts you listen to?
I listen to a bunch of them, man. I'm obsessed with them.
I heard one really interesting. I think I want to listen to it. I never listen to podcasts, to be honest. But somebody told me about it's called Reply All. I was traveling with a really smart, interesting guy to Ethiopia at the moment, just recently, and he Reply All. And this is, he replies every fucking email he gets. Even the guys who sent you, hey, I got 20 million bucks for you. So he replies them. And then he tracks where they come from. And then he flies there and meets them and goes with the story. No, really.
Oh, this is the podcast.
This is the podcast.
Oh, amazing.
And every time he comes up with somebody is saying, hey, I got this and I got that. And hey, we spam. So he replies them all.
Oh, wow.
It's called Reply All.
I'll check that out. I don't want to tell you, if I open that box of what's my favorite podcast, I'm going to end up talking about other podcasts. Because I could talk about, I could do a podcast about podcasts. I love podcasts so much.
What is your favorite podcast?
It's the Blind Boy podcast.
Who is that?
He's an Irish guy. He wears a plastic bag on his head. He's fucking amazing. He's like my guru and my teacher. And
what is he talking about?
History a lot of the time. Art. A lot of music. He's a musician. So the history, let's say, of disco. He deals a lot with mental health.
Why he has a plastic bag on it?
Because, it's funny, one of the reasons I didn't want to talk about it is because I did the podcast with Jorg earlier, and I'm almost conscious that I'm repeating things that other people might have heard me say. So, why is he wearing a plastic bag on his head? Interestingly, I was talking about this earlier, because he doesn't want to be famous. When he started...
But now he's really famous.
Oh, he's really famous now. He interviews, like, Spike Lee, famous. You know, like, he's interviewing really famous people about movies and things, because... He's now a social commentator and an Irish hero. In Ireland, he's considered like...
Does he always have to appear with the plastic bag?
Yeah, yeah. No. But listen, the reason he did that is because... Okay, first of all, it looks like a balaclava, you know, like a terrorist.
Yeah.
So it cuts the eye holes out.
He got eyes.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And a mouth hole.
Yeah.
And him and his friend, they go on stage and do music. They're called the Rubber Bandits. They wear plastic bags on their heads. So no one knows what they look like.
Do you know them?
No. I wish, I'd love to meet him, but there's no way I mean meeting this guy.
Why?
Because he doesn't want to meet people.
But he goes on stage and plays music.
Yeah, yeah.
So we could invite him to the Miller Gallery.
I'm sure, yeah.
Okay, let's do...
I'd love to meet this guy. He's one of my heroes.
Yeah, I don't want to speak about any other podcast no more with you. I want you, with your art, to invite him for the Miller Gallery to play their music.
I don't think he'd be interested in me asking, maybe more interested in you asking him.
Yeah, but I ask him with your art.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Listen, the reason he wears a plastic bag is because the first year when they started, they saw Big Brother, and they didn't want to become another shit celebrity. So they cover their identity. So if it fails, no one cares.
No one cares.
If it succeeds...
No one cares too.
So if they're walking down the street or they're going to a bar, people can't say either you're a genius or you're a prick. It doesn't matter because that's a character. He says he's like Kermit the Frog. Forget about the person with the hand up Kermit the Frog's ass. He's a puppet saying things. So I really respect this guy because he's a genius, but also I don't care about his personal life. I don't want to know if he's married with kids. I like his podcast. And I think there's a lot of problem in the world with celebrities who aren't they're celebrated for nothing. All they're celebrated for is being wealthy celebrities. And again, look at Banksy's a good example of that. Would Banksy's work be better or worse if you knew he was gay or with kids? It would just distract you from the actual thing. How many celebrities, you think they're brilliant in a movie, or they're a great musician, or a great actor, and then you find out they're having a divorce? Who cares? People get divorced. Get on with it. Doesn't need to take up my time. Same with politicians. I wonder, getting back to the thing about blind people with art, I really think about this a lot. Going back to blind people and empathy, I predict the greatest politician in the world would be blind. If the president of the United States was blind, first of all, he can't see what color your skin is.
Although this guy, I'm not allowed to talk a lot about him because I want
visa. We don't mention his name. We just talk about the president of the United States, any of them.
I think the current one is in a lot of ways really blind. And I agree on you, if he would be blind, he would be a good president.
I tell you what, that magic spell of empathy, you know when people say, what would be your superpower? My superpower would be I would zap empathy into someone, because I would love to take the greatest, not even the politicians, but the billionaires, the Bill Gates of the world, and point empathy, man, zap empathy. So you get to feel what this little girl feels like when she has no water. And that, I think, is the...
So we have to write an email to info@marvel.com.
Yeah, right.
Start with the empathy.
But if you were blind, and also deaf... So it's almost the disabilities, the weaknesses of the world, being able to see and hear. If you you get the information from this person, they're not a man or a woman, they're not rich or poor, they're not black or white, the information is given to me, and this is what they need. I'm the president, I'm going to help you get it. That should be your job, work for the people. Doesn't matter if they're millionaires, doesn't matter if they've got no money, doesn't matter if they're black or white. And it's really alarming to me that we're still dealing with it when there's stuff in America that's so basic. Like, are you seriously still talking about color? Like, are you still having that divide? And it's more than ever, maybe because there's more people, but that division.
No, because the, in Germany it's called the Auseinandersetzung, the coping with it and thinking about it and having dialogues about it teaching it in school and university is not done on a major deep level. It's the same also with Germany. Like, if you see it now, we of course we had it in school, we had it in university, we had it all the over, but it was not done on a majorly deep level. So there is no real transformation, there's only a superficial transformation, but we haven't coped with our problems we had in the Nazi time. So still, they're coming back.
Oh, very difficult. But maybe it's in us all anyway, because we're all cavemen. You know, that we're not that different to how our ancient ancestors were protecting the cave. What is different is that there's 7.5 billion people in that cave. Because planet Earth is one boat, really, floating in space.
Technology. We have the resources.
Yeah.
We have the interconnection.
Absolutely. The one thing that's missing out of all of it is empathy. And I really think that every day of my life, when I see or read or hear about problems of the world, it's so basic to me. It's like, well, just put yourself in that situation. Whether you're a soldier pointing a gun or whether you're a businessman buying an apartment, and the way you've got to think, hang on, what if by some cosmic lottery we roll the dice again and I end up being that little girl in the village in Ethiopia, or I end up being that homeless person? And people can't do it, even with all the technology and all the resources and all the interconnectivities of the internet. People walk around thinking, me, 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 rather than we should go around thinking, you, 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 you. And I think empathy should be taught at school. Along with yoga and mindfulness. Yeah, empathy. Right now, every day, we're going to do 30 minutes of empathy. Put yourself in her shoes. What does it feel like to be a woman? It's all coming out with the Me Too thing. People are suddenly, after thousands of years, suddenly men are like, oh yeah, it's not nice to be treated like that, is it? Oh, sorry. Sorry.
It sounds so stupid and ridiculous. I know. But it is true.
I know.
So...
We're really sorting out the problems of the world, you and me, in this hotel room today, aren't we?
I'm trying to be empathetic now, try to be David Chillingnaw. Fuck.
All right,
there's so many ideas in my head now.
Let me talk about the print, because I am very proud of this print, and as we've already said about going to Ethiopia, and I feel like it was a genuine life lesson for me, because I've travelled a lot, and honestly, this was one of the hardest trips I've been on. Mainly because the paint didn't turn up, the facilities were often difficult. You know, there were a lot of things that were a challenge to me. And yet I think it was one of the best trips I've ever been on. So it was one of the hardest trips, but one of the best trips. And I think it's a real calling for me to try and use my art, because my art is quite, it attempts to be universal. And when I say that, I mean that I want as many people to not just read it, but understand it. And if they can't understand it, at least enjoy it, like a piece of music. If you can hear a piece of music in another language, you can still dance to it. That's my ambition, is to like make art that can be danced to, even if you don't understand the lyrics of the song. And that was a real opportunity you gave me, because taking it to Ethiopia, where not just the language is different, but the culture is different, the history is different, everything is so different. And as a testament to the reason we were there, and for my own practice, to be able to paint something on the side of a wall in where no one knows who I am and no one really cares, and yet they were enjoying the visual music.
Yeah, everything.
And I feel more than ever that art has a function in realizing that level of enjoyment. So in the same way that food, when you feed people, obviously there's certain types of food that certain people don't eat, but music as well, it has, for me, art is on the same level as music and food. It's something we don't really need it, but at the same time we really need it. And I think that was an interesting experiment for me, because it's usually when I go and do a project like this, it's so organized. It's a street art festival. There's spray paint. Or at least the project has happened two or three times before. Or it's in a refugee camp where people are just waiting to be entertained. This wasn't. This was on the side of the road in Bahada or Addis Ababa. And people were just like, what are you doing? And I couldn't explain it. And in a way, I think the art explained it for me. Also, the help of other people, like Ashanafi helping me translate things into Amharic. But the test of a universal aesthetic, something that is like telling a story without any words. And like I said, 7.5 billion people, they're bound to get it wrong somewhere along the line. But there is this driving force in me to make things that is like the question, like, can art help save the world? Now, the answer is no, because the world's in trouble. But because the world's in trouble, it needs help even more. And I think, like, what are my skills? Yeah, I could maybe help build a house for someone, or I could make some food. But my skill really is to make pictures. And sometimes that's like a problem for me. It's like, what am I doing really to help? What am I doing? Am I making money so that I can then have a better life for myself and my family? Or is there something I can do to contribute towards the problems? And honestly, I'm so grateful for the opportunity. I think that's why I'm really excited about this print, is to do something and then continue it on, because it feels more than ever that the world needs help. And when I say the world needs help, I mean, let's get some drinking water to people who don't have it, or toilets to people who don't have it. But also more than ever, I need a reason to help. Like, I feel that.
You know what Hannah Arendt said?
Who's that?
A German philosopher and a really smart woman. And she was also, after the Nazi time, she was a journalist on the Eichmann process. And there's also a nice documentary out there at the moment. And she said, only an engaged life is a happy life. Which really is, for me, like the key to, because a lot of people then give you shoulder, I don't know, you know.
Yeah, you pat yourself on the back.
Yeah, you're doing such a good job and stuff like that. And to be honest, I do it for myself.
Yeah.
In the first and to most honest, I do it for myself. And the person who profits most is me.
And getting back to those different points of power, like I was saying to you the other day about how you can have Instagram fame, you can have financial gain, and then, like you're saying, the thing where you are satisfied by yourself, that can be because people applaud you, look and go, you're wonderful. But when I was in Ethiopia and a few other places where I've painted, when the children or even the parents of the children, they don't know who you are, and you're sitting there, you finished and you look and you realize that they love it and you feel good, but no one's even congratulating you. Strangely, that's an even better feeling. It's deeper. It's like sitting on the aeroplane coming back from Ethiopia, and I was like,
wow,
I definitely fucking did something there. And it's definitely not... I tried to put stuff online about it when I got back. I wanted to make a little film, and it just didn't work. Like, a few of the time lapses look good, But there was a part of it that I couldn't put into words, I couldn't put into pictures, that was something where I had this huge emotional sense of achievement and no one was thanking me for it. And that was significant, you know? That felt good because actually, when you're looking for approval from other people that you don't know on the internet, or from someone who's giving you money, or from your friends and family, the best approval comes from right inside your gut. And it's almost like you're having a conversation with yourself, you know, about yourself. You're having like a heavy meta conversation like, well, you did something there, didn't you? Yes, I fucking did. And how does it feel? It feels brilliant and no one's thanking you. That's all right because I'm thanking myself. It's like really strange dialogue. And you don't often get a chance to do that. It's too much is emphasized on money. How much did you get paid? How many likes did you get? And as I get older, I'm like, that shit doesn't matter. Actually, it just leaves you wanting more. How much money do you need? I always think that's funny that I have an idea that the millionaires and the billionaires of the world, you should have you can have 10 million. That's as much as you need. That's my philosophy. If I was king of the world, the first thing I'd do is, right, the richest you can get is 10 million. Because if you fuck it up with 10 million, you didn't deserve it. Because think of how much more money there is in the world after the 10 millions. Because 10 million, you can retire with 10 million. You can buy a castle and not have to pay any bill. You just earn interest. And I think sometimes about that, like money. At what point do you stop earning money?
Have you ever read Ulysses?
Ulysses, James Joyce.
Yeah.
No, I've read bits. It's a big one, isn't it? I've tried to read it.
Actually, it's like hanging around with you.
Is it?
Yeah, it's called Stream of Consciousness.
Yeah.
You're speaking without thinking. Oh, you're speaking without...
And I'm probably going to listen back to this.
You listen to that shit?
What, would I listen to my own voice?
Podcast?
Not as much as you'd think. I find it really difficult to watch videos of myself and listen to myself on a podcast. Because I will listen back to this and I'll be like, ah, you idiot. Why did you say that?
Yeah.
Or why didn't you say that?
No, I love talking to you.
Thanks, man. I love talking to you.
So, thanks a lot for having us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, genuinely, from the bottom of my heart, for giving me the opportunity.
Shut the fuck up. Thank you from the bottom of my heart for supporting that cause. You're one of the most amazing artists we're working for a long time. It's also sometimes difficult if you work closely with artists. Sometimes you fuck it up and then there is like, you don't have a clean relationship. You know, like this really like white, there is no... Of course, you're not an artist with a lot of white because you're always crazy colorful, but it's a thankful, grateful, beautiful relationship, and we appreciate it.
Well, here's a quote for you that I'll end on, which is actually something that I hold dear to myself, right? Which is, success is maintaining what you love. And that is something I live by because, honestly, I'm not searching for money and I'm not searching for fame. What I'm searching for is to maintain what I love. And what I love is making art. But at this point in my life, I am searching for higher context, higher meaning, something that is a spiritual, that feeling in my gut when I was on the aeroplane coming back from Ethiopia, thinking, fucking hell, that was hard, but that was amazing. The best you feel is when you're tired from working hard at what you love. And success is maintaining what I love, and I feel like working with Viva Con Agua helps me maintain what I love because it gives me that higher context and it gives me something to like work hard for that's not about me. And it's genuinely inspires me. I take it back to my studio with me and I want to keep that relationship going because I really feel like what you're doing is amazing and the way you work with artists, and I really look forward to doing more work with you. It's great. So if you want to buy the print, which is what we're kind of talking about here, we just released the screen print, 4-color, A2, it's a nice print. You can buy them on Viva Millenthorne Gallery, Big Cartel. Search for it. Search for my shit, and then the link will be there. But yeah, the reality of the print is there's 50, they're €150 each. If we sell them all, you dig a well in Ethiopia. It's the same amount of money. And how many people get drinking water from a well?
Between 500 and 1,000.
There you go. That's amazing. That, let's say, 1,000 people will drink fresh water. And how many, just out of interest, how many wells have you dug now in Ethiopia?
With the rig or in total?
In total.
In Ethiopia, I would guess something like 40, 50.
And how many people benefit from that for drinking and sanitation?
I don't have real numbers here for the country of Ethiopia, so we had to...
Because you work in Uganda and Nepal and...
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, so many countries. But and the monitoring is quite hard. Because you have, it's community based, so
yeah, you got to teach people to look after.
Yeah, you always do it like estimated 7 people for a family.
Sure.
Then you have like 500 family. Then you calculate time.
But generally, have you got a figure of the people that
there is this
in the last how long?
3 million people.
3 million people.
We have free access to clean drinking water due to Viva Con Agua.
That's nuts.
That's crazy.
It's brilliant, and it's. It's just a reminder of how lucky we are to just be able to drink water out of a tap here.
Yeah.
It's just a basic human need that those 3 million people wouldn't have had.
And I go now for a basic need, I take a piss, and I really appreciate Mr. Schilling Law, like the teacher told you. So thanks a lot.
Cool, man. Thank you. This is Viva Con Agua.